want to finish off our discussion of discrete symmetries in the Standard Model. And we introduced parity before. Parity is supposed to change x into minus x or p into minus p. And we introduced this eta. So we had particle and we had a complex scalar field phi, a function of space-time coordinates. And this was a particle or antiparticle state. And we introduced this eta times minus p. And eta squared was equal to 1. And then it's again particle or antiparticle. And then we moved it through the field. It's a unitary operator. We figured out how it acts on the creation and annihilation operators. And then we had it act by on the field. So this is the usual thing in quantum mechanics. The symmetry operator, when it acts on the state, it's P. And when it acts on the operators, it's a similarity transformation. P is P dagger is P inverse. And so it looks like this. And then we got eta, this constant eta that's plus or minus 1, squares to 1 because p squared is 1. So we got this very nice transformation law for phi. And of course, what we want to do in the end is construct Lagrangians that are invariant under this symmetry, or at least part of them is invariant under this symmetry. If the symmetry is very badly broken by everything, we wouldn't even talk about it as a symmetry, right? So the fact that I'm talking about parity should tell you ahead of time that at least parts of the Standard Model will conserve parity. Well, I got asked a question. I forget who asked it last time. Maybe about why didn't I take a different eta for the particle or antiparticle? Who asked that last time? Were you there? And then I kind of dismissed it, right? I badmouthed you a little bit. But I had regrets later in the day as I thought about it more. So I'm going to give you two quarters to make up for it. But don't spend it all in one place. I got to get rid of all my quarters today. This Canadian money is very heavy. If I carry it all, my pants will fall down or something at the airport when I take my belt off. So what would happen if we had used a different eta for the particle and antiparticle? Well, we would have done P on the field like this. It contains the A and the B parts of it. The A and the B correspond to the particle and the antiparticle. And we'd end up with this minus sign between them. This would be just some crazy transformation. I couldn't even write it in terms of phi. I'd have an awful time trying to write down theories that are invariant under parity, interacting theories. So we don't want to do that. It'll all be bad. We won't be able to write Lorentz invariant interacting theories that are invariant under parity, according to the usual ways we've been constructing Lagrangian. And so in this case, the appropriate thing to do is assign the particle and the antiparticle as the same transformation under parity. But we got to check as we go forward, as we go marching forward, we should always check, you know, what transformation law for particles and antiparticles works, makes the fields transform in a simple way so we can write parity invariant Lagrangians in addition to Lorentz invariant, etc. So now I'm just going to tell you how parity is defined on the various fields and make a few remarks, because I don't have the time to go through this exercise for every field. And it gets more complicated, particularly the fermion field is much more complicated. Because you got those spinners, and you got to change p to minus p in the spinners and see what happens to them. It's kind of complicated. So for the fermion fields, so this is like an electron field. And we're going to adopt the conventions of how you choose eta for the electron field. So there's a gamma naught. It does the usual thing, minus x. But to get this very simple Lorentz transformation, it's a very simple parity transformation, you have to assign the electron and the positron opposite intrinsic parities. The problem we had here was if they were opposite, and if we tried to make them the same here, it would go into some god-awful thing. And so the electron has parity plus one, and the positron, by convention, parity minus one. And finally, there's the photon field. Yes?
Is it the creation operator for the electron, the creation operator for the positron?
The A and the B.
We
have different ones. Yeah. And finally, there's the photon. Well, depending on what classical E and M course you took, you probably discussed how to A mu's transform with the E's and B's under parity, so I'll just write out the results. And with these definitions, you can check, for example, that electrodynamics is invariant under parity, and the weak interactions actually are not invariant under parity. We'll come to that in a moment. Okay, there's one more discrete symmetry I want to talk about. Uh-oh. Thank you. I got to get rid of these quarters. Every person who corrects something gets a quarter today till I run out. Good catch. Okay, the other symmetry we're going to talk about changes particles into antiparticles. So it's a little bit different. It's going to take an A into a B, for example, in the scale. So if we went back to the scalar field, C, A of P, C could equal, let's say, A to B. And you know, again, we'll take C squared equals 1. So if we repeat it twice, we get 1. And then if you follow it all through as we did before, it ends up, it's eta. Oh, maybe I should show you this. Can't rush it too much. Then you end up not understanding anything, even though the temptation is to rush. So how am I starting? I want CP particle to equal eta P antiparticle. And so C A, C will be A to B. And A to squared is 1 again. And so what happens? Let's say we take C, phi of x, C. Well, again, in the Fourier transform, the only things that are operators are the A's and B's. We get an eta out front. And so I change the A and... Oh, I'm sorry. So phi, I have to write the expansion again, was integral d3p over 2 pi. Oh, my notes have a lot of mistakes. I don't care. I'm going to fix it on the board. So now I want to take C, phi of x, C. So this thing here becomes, I pull out the eta, becomes B of P. This becomes A of P dagger. And that's just eta phi star. So again, a pretty simple transformation law. And under charge conjugation, you figure out how the photon transforms so that the Lagrangian for quantum electrodynamics is invariant under charge conjugation. It's its own antiparticle, so it's kind of a funky thing. It's going to take it into itself. So we get minus A mu. And similarly, if I went through the fermion, a little more complicated because of the spinners, get minus I gamma 2 psi star of x. So when you write out your Lagrangian, now usually the Lagrangian is always bilinear in the fermion field. So it's important not to have to transform it every time, just to work out once how all the fermion bilinears transform, and then you can easily see how something transforms under parity or charge conjugation. Yes? Are you talking about this line? Minus I gamma 2. It comes from how the spinners behave. It's how you relate a V spinner to a U spinner. It's a little bit complicated, so I didn't do it in class. Okay, so I'm going to write out this table. Then I'm going to sing for posterity the Psi fight song so it can be recorded for eternity. You'll have a little break, and then we'll go back to physics. But first I have to answer this question. Is that correct? Or was it about the fight song? Okay. Well, it's not an antilinear operator, it's a linear operator. So this is just what it does on a field. If there was an A in here, it wouldn't get complex conjugated, it would just get pulled out. That's actually a very good question. Ugh, to give you another quarter. No, charge conjugation just takes particle to antiparticle. And it's a linear unitary operator. Right, there isn't. And actually, there is one more operator, which is time reversal. And it's related to complex. If there was an I here, it would become minus I when you pulled it. Yeah. So
I'm just going back to parity a little bit. Parity looks like it's not a very large design.
Well, it takes x goes to minus x, so, but it leaves the interval invariant. It's sort of a discrete, right? If you want to define Lorentz transformations as things that leave the, you know, ds squared invariant, which is usually how you do it, setting c to 1, it does leave the, so some the Lorentz transformations are the ones that are continuously connected to the identity, and sometimes you add discrete ones to it too. Any other questions? Okay, so let me write out this little table, which I stole from Peskin and Schroeder. But it, now that I've given them credit, I don't think it's considered stealing. It's a nice table to have. So this is something you have to work out. I'm not working it out for you. And so there's parity, charge conjugation, and now I'm just going to do the product of the two. And it's convenient to introduce this notation, minus 1 to the mu. And that's going to be equal to 1 for mu equals 0, because different components of the 4 vector can transform differently. And minus 1 to the mu equals minus 1 for mu equals 1, 2, 3. That's sort of a definition. So, oh, shoot. I made it on the top of my table. I suck. Rewrite the table. Am I in the middle? Where is this, the middle board? I guess so. Sorry. So we have P, C, CP. The I is nothing here, it's just convention. Just I copied it like a mindless gnome from Peskin. And I'll just do, so this you get parity, plus 1, plus 1, plus, it's all. Uh-oh, minus 1. When you have a gamma 5, the parity is to charge conjugation is still plus 1, and the CP is minus 1. Psi bar gamma mu psi transforms like, oh, I need psi bar gamma mu gamma 5 psi. This transforms like a 4 vector, a true 4 vector. And the gamma 5 is flipped. Okay, so basically the gamma 5 Oh, I think there's a mistake here somewhere. No, looks okay. Except for CP, the gamma 5 flips the properties of both C and P. Doesn't flip CP. Yeah? Oh, basically it's because of the gamma naught. If you move the gamma naught through gamma 5, you get a minus sign in the definition of parity. Okay, time for our break so the sci-fight song can be recorded for all eternity. Big sister, are you there? Hello?
Hello?
Hi. Okay. Jeez, that's a spooky thing. You ready, class? Okay. You feel free to sing along with me, although I didn't produce any other lyrics. I hear the train a-coming, it's rolling round the bend, and I ain't seen the sunshine since, oh, I don't know when. I'm stuck in PI Institute, and problem sets keep coming on, but that train keeps a-rolling on down to Hamilton. When I was just a baby, my mama told me, child, always be a good one. Don't ever play with Hamiltonians. But I did a problem set in Reno just to have a try. When I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head and cry. I bet there's rich folks eating in a fancy dining car. They're probably drinking coffee and smoking big cigars. But I know I had it coming. I know I can't be free. But those people keep them moving, and that's what tortures me. Well, if they freed me from this institute, if that railroad train was mine, I bet I'd move it over a little farther down the line, far from PI Institute. That's where I want to stay. And I'd let that lonesome whistle blow my blues away. Okay, thank you. Okay, back to physics. Let's take a simple, very simple little theory and talk about, you know, whether it's invariant under parity, CP, etc. So we're not going to do the standard model to start with. We're going to take, what did I take here? A real scalar field and a Dirac fermion. They have the usual free parts in the Lagrangian without interactions. And then I write an interaction term. And it looks like this. Where GA and GB are real. If they're real, I need the I here because I get a minus sign when I add the Hermitian conjugate. And so this makes the Lagrangian Hermitian. So this is some theory, a toy theory, not the real world, something we're just going to consider. And now we have to ask ourselves, how should we choose eta in this theory? Well, we should choose it to try to make it invariant under parity. Okay, so first of all, let's set a theory with GB equals 0. Well, if GB is equal to 0, then I could assign phi an eta plus 1, and this would be invariant under parity and CP. Similarly, if GA was 0, I could go with minus 1. But if both GA and GB are non-zero, it's not invariant under parity. And it's also not invariant under charge conjugation times parity. Okay, so that was pretty simple. This is a theory when both GA and GB are non-zero that violates parity and CP. Assigning C a positive charge conjugation, let's say in this case, would make it conserve CP. But that's a bold-faced lie. for a subtle reason, which I'm about to tell you. So here we go. Let's try to be a little more. Oh, I forgot to say one thing. I'm going to take the fermions as massless. It's actually not a lie in general, but in this case it is. Okay, so let's write out the whole Lagrangian. Let's think about this argument a little bit more. Let's write out the whole Lagrangian. Oh, I'm going to change notation a bit. I'm going to write GA plus IGB as equal to G e to the I phi G. So put in a phase. You know, the cosine that gives you G times the cosine gives you GA, and sine gives you GB. And then I can rewrite the Lagrangian. Oh, sorry, I. So I got to call this thing something. So I'm going to call it G, the whole thing together like that. So this is G phi psi bar right psi left plus Hermitian conjugate. Because when you add the Hermitian conjugate, it gives you that thing there, the real part with the 1 and the imaginary part with the gamma 5. So this is just another way to rewrite that Lagrangian. Haven't done anything but rewrite the theory in this way, breaking it up in terms of left and right. The only term that connects left and right in this theory is this one. But you know that when you have a field theory, you're always allowed to make field redefinitions. And so let's try to rewrite this field theory, making some field redefinitions. So this is the same Lagrangian, just rewritten in this way in terms of left and right. Yes? Yeah. Thank you. So that's our goal. I'm going to try to remove the phase of this coupling so that it's a real number by putting that phase into the definitions of the fields. So one of the couple, if you break it in, so part of that coupling is illusionary. It doesn't affect any physics because I can absorb it into the phase of the field. So that's the goal of this exercise. So what I'm going to do is take psi, which one did I do in my notes? Yeah, I'm going to say psi left prime is e to the I phi g psi left, and psi right prime is just psi right. Now, usually when you write your Lagrangian, you want to have the kinetic terms have the standard form, the mass terms to be real and positive, the kinetic term to just be this. And you can see with this redefinition, this becomes just prime, 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 prime. The phase cancels out. If I had a mass term, that wouldn't be true because the mass term couples left to right, so I wouldn't be able to do this and stick with real masses, which I want to do. But we said we're going to specialize to massless fields. And so this becomes I psi left bar prime d slash psi left prime plus I psi right bar prime d slash psi right prime plus the magnitude of g phi psi bar right prime psi left prime plus Hermitian conjugate. And once I write it like this, I can just take the primes off. You never know where you started. And so G is real. This theory conserves CP. And that's the end of the story. So here's the rule for understanding whether a Lagrangian violates CP. It's kind of an abridged version of the story, but CP is harder to violate than parity or charge conjugation alone. It requires imaginary couplings, like in this example. But you have to be careful. You take your Lagrangian, you look around at all the coupling constants, see if there's any that have imaginary parts, or complex couplings, imaginary parts. And then you see whether you can remove that by redefining the phases. If you can't remove it, your theory violates charge conjugation times parity, CP. So I've just sort of sketched out the idea here. I really haven't done enough steps to prove that. So if you don't feel I've proved that, it's OK. I've just tried to make it plausible with the steps here. Yes? That's my next step. Yes? Well, that was my later remark. In this model, it did. And I'm claiming that's true in general, but I haven't really shown you enough to do that. Would sort of be a, I'd have to go through in detail how all the terms transform in the Lagrangian, and I just don't have time to do that in this remaining lecture. So you'll have to take my word on it. You've seen a little toy model where it happens. The standard model clearly violates parity. Having the W bosons coupled like W mu 1 minus gamma 5. If you have both the 1 and the gamma 5, it's not invariant under parity. But that's not enough to get CP violation. You have to have complex coupling. So think back in the standard model. Where do we have complex couplings? Almost nowhere except the CKM matrix was an arbitrary 3x3 unitary matrix. Such a matrix in general will have complex entries. And therefore, that's the source of possible CP violation in the standard model. Apart from a non-perturbative source called theta QCD, which perhaps will get discussed in the second half of field theory. So let's examine this. We're not done yet. Maybe we can make transformations on the quark fields to remove that phase from the CKM matrix. So we have to go through that argument. We have to discuss that a little bit. OK, so let me remind you where it occurred in the Lagrangian. So we had a term in the Lagrangian. I don't know what to call it. It's a particular term where the W boson's coupled. It's not the whole Lagrangian. These are left-handed, gamma mu. And then we had VCKM, the CKM matrix. DSB, all left-handed. Now, the quark mass terms, after we diagonalize the quark mass matrix by those unitary transformations I talked about, that's where V came from, the quark mass terms are real. And they look like this. It couples left to right. And so in this Lagrangian here, I can make separate phase transformations on each of these quark fields here. So this would be u bar left, u right, and then compensate with u right undoing it so the masses stay real. Is that clear to everybody? So if I write down v in general, I can change it and try to get rid of the complex phases in it by six separate transformations. I have six real parameters that I can use to adjust to cancel the complex phases in v. So six phase redefinitions. But wait. If I take all of these by a common phase, that's exactly the same thing as all of these by a common phase. It's just e to the I phi times the identity either way, or the opposite phase. And so really, I have to subtract 1. So I have 5 independent phase redefinitions. Everybody got that? OK. But now we have to count parameters in V. OK, V is a 3x3 unitary matrix. So 3x3 matrix with complex entries, it has 9 times 2, 18 real parameters it's characterized by. 3 by 3. 18 real parameters. But it satisfies constraints, right? It satisfies V dagger V equals 1, or V star JI, VJK is delta IK, written out in terms of components. So you can see if you set J equal to, if you look at I equal to K, it's just the absolute value squared of those things is 1 summed over. This is summed over J. Repeated index is summed. So that's really 3 real constraints, not complex constraints. So I get -3. And then I have the off-diagonal elements, which is, one is the complex conjugate of the other, so it's -6 real constraints. And so a general unitary matrix 3 by 3 has got 9 parameters. But I said I could remove 5 of them by those phase definitions. So we're left with 4 parameters. Let's say the matrix was orthogonal. How would you write it? What would you express it in terms of? Somebody answer this for me. I'm going to go crazy if you don't answer it. That's kind of an idle threat. But anyways, it could. If it was orthogonal, how would you write it? What did they teach you in classical mechanics? Right, Euler angles. Have a quarter. Good catch. Have another. I want to see if you can repeat it. It's an experiment. Oh, my God. One more. fine. Okay. That's better. That's better. Finally dropped. Yeah. That leaves us with one parameter. That's a complex phase. This is how CP violation comes in the standard model. Now, if I went through this argument again, I have it in my notes, but I don't quite have probably have time. Maybe we should do it. Well, you'll do it. Let's say they were just, I guess I should do it. It's like I'm on strike or something. Work the rule. I won't do it for you. It's kind of a famous thing, so even though it's a little bit of a diversion, I should do it. So, you know, these quarks and the generations, they came one at a time, right? We didn't discover all the quarks at once because the higher generations are heavier. You have to get the higher energy accelerators to make those quarks. So at one time, there were just 2 generations, not 6 quarks, but 4 quarks. So V would be a 2 by 2 matrix in that case. So if you have a 2 by 2 unitary matrix, let's go through the counting in that case. If you have a 2 by 2 unitary matrix, so that's up, down, strange, charm. Then, okay, so it's got 8 real parameters if it's just 2 by 2 complex matrix. Then it's got 2 diagonal constraints real, 2 off diagonal, -4. So 8 minus 4 is 4. So we're left with 1 angle, if it was orthogonal in 2 dimensions, and 3 phases. But, you know, you have up, charm, down, strange, and just like before, I can make 3 independent phase transformations, getting us down to the 1 parameter, and so it's real. So if we only had 2 generations, we'd have no source of CP violation in the standard model. And Kobayashi and Miskawa realized this, and they wrote a paper saying, so CP non-conservation was observed. It was observed a long time ago in the 1960s. So we, oh man, I'm into the story now in a big way, but I'll divert for a moment and answer your question. The moment is past. I'll get back to it. Right. Oh, because I have six, so I have all these six fields, right? Each one I can make a separate phase transformation on. Except that overcounts, because if I make the same one here, and the same one here, it does exactly the same thing. So that's the argument. Now, those arguments don't always work. It's possible when you count independent things, there could be things that are redundant, but in this case, it works, the general counting of parameters. So what was I saying? Yeah, so Kobayashi and Moskawa, they propose that there should be another generation to explain the CP violation observed, and they won the Nobel Prize. Basically, that's the content of their paper. It has another, they also talk about adding more scalar fields as a possible way to get it. That one looks kind of wrong. So I've now given, and then they wrote down a parameterization for V. So I'll finish that by writing a parameterization for V. And then you'll see what goes into a Nobel Prize in particle physics. Basically, it's an understanding of the number of parameters in a 3x3 matrix and some physical insight. So it's not how complicated. So the lesson is, it doesn't have to be really hard. If you're not a math jock, come to particle physics. Win the Nobel Prize. It'll all be good. Okay, so V, we're going to write out, this is just a particular, well, sometimes people just give the elements the names like this. And now I'll give you one parameterization. So we're going to need three angles and a phase. We're going to call the angles theta 1, theta 2, and theta 3, and the phase delta. And we're going to, kind of sort of big. You remember the Euler angle matrix is kind of disgusting. This will be equally, this will be a little more disgusting. So we're going to adopt the notation that ci is cosine theta I, and si is sine theta I. Okay? So now, this is just one particular parameterization. Like the Euler angles is just one particular way to write a 3x3 matrix. That's orthogonal. You don't have to pick that. There's an infinite number of ways to make the three independent rotations to write it. So here we go. But this is one of them. Probably there'll be a minus sign that's wrong here somewhere. It's kind of inevitable. But so you should go to the particle data book and don't take it from your notes if you're ever doing some research here, just in case I messed up one element or something. But I want you to just sort of get the flavor of it. Should I keep writing this? Is it helping you? Is it comforting you? Oh, shoot. I didn't do it like this. I labeled it in a different way. I probably took this from the particle data book, not from my notes. So I guess it's theta 1, 2, theta 1, 3, theta 2, 3, and this is the I that's going in here. I'm sorry. And it ends up that all the angles are small. That's just an experimental fact. It didn't have to be that way. So all the angles are small. Don't pay too much attention to that equation. It's just a fat equation. It doesn't really tell you that much. Well, I mentioned to you that CP violation's been observed, so I'm a physicist. I should tell you a little bit about that. So I'm going to tell you barely enough, like the bare minimum, to get by. So it's been observed in two places, in B meson decays and in kaon decays. So what I'm going to define for you are certain physical quantities that were measured, and those quantities would be zero if CP was conserved, and they're measured to be non-zero. So let's step through that for a moment. Yeah, sorry. This class got a little less derivation than some of them, but. Well, there's the big matrix, and we'll talk a little more about it in a moment. So, examples. So, in the kaon system, the neutral kaon system, we have K naught and K naught bar, and CP takes one to the other. Negative parity and charge conjugation just takes one to the other. And so CP K naught is equal minus K naught bar and vice versa. And so if you have the states K naught and K naught bar, we can form from them CP eigenstates. If CP is conserved, they'll be eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. Not, they won't be eigenstates otherwise. So we don't observe the k-naught and k-naught bar. What's really observed are two states, k-long and k-short. It's not that one is longer than the other. One lives longer than the other. Lifetime. Yeah, that would be cool if one was longer than the other. But anyways, let's go on. So this is k-naught minus k. And CP, so now these are the two states always, and what follows here is true if CP is conserved. Yes?
Is CKM eigenstate the same as
mass
eigenstate?
Did I say CKM
eigenstate?
Yeah, I think I said CP eigenstate.
Okay.
Has definite CP. Maybe I misspoke, I'm not sure. Sometimes I don't say the right thing. Okay, so if I look at CP on K long, it's equal to minus K long, and K short, this is K, oh man, I've really gone nuts here. This is K short, sorry. Okay, so there always are two states. They're observed in nature. So this line's the two states. If CP was conserved, so these are the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. If CP was conserved, they'd be these linear combinations of K dot and K dot bar with these values for the CP quantum number. So usually people form these quantities eta plus minus, which is defined to be this. Then there's some Hamiltonian that causes the transition from the weak interactions. And so this is the definition of eta plus minus. And there's similarly an eta 0, 0, where these are pi zeros. And if you have a pi plus pi minus, when they come from a kaon decay like this, they're always in an S wave. To conserve, they have spin zero, and so they have zero angular momentum. Charge conjugation takes the pi plus to pi minus, and pi minus to pi plus, and any minus signs would cancel out because it does both. And then the parity is even, and so this is a CP even state. And so eta plus minus would be equal to zero if CP was conserved. Mm-hmm. Did you ask something, or was that a stretch?
So you have a lot of states that aren't eigenstates of various quantities and are or aren't observed. The k naught and k naught bar are eigenstates of what?
So, for example, the k naught and k naught bar have definite strangeness. They're eigenstates of the strangeness operator. One has a strange quark, one has an anti-strange quark. So one you'd assign strangeness 1 and the other strangeness minus 1. Well, as k-short and k-long don't have definite strangeness, but they're the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian if you have CP non-conservation. Well, they're the observed eigenstates, let's put it that way. Does that help? So this thing is observed. Eta plus minus is measured. It was measured in the 1960s. A Nobel Prize was awarded for it to the experimentalist who measured it. And it has the value of about 2 times 10 to the minus 3. I didn't look it up again, so I don't, it's measured pretty accurately. This is just me. Pretty small, but definitely CP is violated. I'd like to do another one. Another example for you. Involving, yes?
What is eta 0, 0?
Eta 0, 0 is the same thing as this with pi zeros. So I saved a little time, didn't write it down. And it's almost equal to the same value. But although in principle they could be different. Everybody with me so far? One more example of a CP violating quantity, then I'll tell you a little more about V, the CKM matrix, and what we know about it. And then it'll be... Parting is such... Okay, so here's another one, which has been measured much more recently. They built a whole accelerator, basically, to study this. Two of them, one in Japan and one at Stanford. So you take a B meson, a B zero, a B bar, and a D. And you see the CP non-conservation in the kaon system is small, so for this argument we're going to neglect it. Assume that the CP is conserved in the kaon system, that the K short to CP eigenstate. What fractions mean?
Sorry,
I'm going to explain that in a moment. I have to tell you what the states are. Two people discovered this state. One named it the J, and one named it the psi. So sometimes people call it J/psi. I think everyone calls it psi now, but I'm old enough that it was still J/psi in my day. But I'll tell you what it is in a moment. Not the most pedagogical guy in the world. What can I do? You are what you are, right? Okay, so J psi, it's a C bar C bound state. So it's one of these oniums that we talked about, at least if you treat the charm as heavy. And it's got particular quantum numbers. It's a spin one. It's got negative parity and negative charge conjugation, just like the photon. You make it by a single photon, actually. So this is a CP eigenstate. This is a CP eigenstate, CP plus, CP minus. There's a unit of orbital angular momentum. Oh, CP plus, sorry, 1 minus minus. So the final state's CPI, but it's the same CP in both cases. So this is a CP eigenstate, this final state. And so if I take CP, it takes a B naught into a B naught bar. This stays the same. So these two ranks should be equal by CP. These are CP conjugates, and this is a self-conjugate. So this asymmetry, because of the minus sign, if it was non-zero, would violate CP. And it's been measured, and it's about 1. That was a great triumph of the machines built in up at Stanford in Japan. Okay, so in the last 10 minutes of the class, I think I'm going to step through and tell you a little bit about what we know about V. V comes into any of the weak interactions involving quarks. When you have a particular quark, you know, when you have like a U quark going to a down quark and a W boson, when you write the Feynman rule for this vertex, you get the G2 over 2 root 2, the gamma mu, the 1 minus gamma 5, and you get the V UB and UD in this case. And if it was a charm, you'd get CD, et cetera, filling out the whole matrix. So they're all observable quantities depending on what the case you look at. Is this clear to everybody? So I want to say a little bit about the matrix. We know quite a bit about it now, but it took a while. So let's step through that. Everybody with me? Okay. First of all, there's different ways of parameterizing the matrix, and there's one sort of geometric way of thinking about things that's kind of useful. So first of all, as I mentioned before, all the angles are small. The phase delta is not small, but all the angles are small, so it's close to the identity of the matrix V. It ends up that because neutrinos have mass, there's an analog matrix in the neutrino sector. It's not close to, the angles are big. Before neutrinos, before we experimentally it was worked out, all the theorists thought the angles would be small because we got an example when they're small. The lesson from that is, what the hell do theorists know? Just do the experiments and find out how it really goes. Don't let your prejudice get in the way.
Excuse me.
Yes?
If we write on CKM matrix, you know, just last time I asked, and you mentioned there's a FF dual term, right?
That also violates CT.
That's a strong interaction.
It's a strong interaction one, and furthermore, it's much more subtle in this example. It requires non-perturbative dynamics to see how it affects things. If you just do perturbation theory, it contributes zero.
So there's time I ask a question, say, not just the strong sectors, strong QCD sector, if you go to weak interaction, the SU2 gauge field can also have the FF dual term.
Yeah.
So I wonder that term also violates CT.
Yeah.
So why don't people...
It also requires non-perturbative physics to understand it, and that's even smaller for the weak interactions, non-perturbative. There's a lot of subtleties associated with non-perturbative physics and gauge theories and anomalies, and I've left that out in this class.
Yeah, but somehow my understanding is that people even don't discuss this term anymore.
Because it's so small. It's like unbelievably small. For example, the standard model gives you proton decay.
Yeah.
In the standard model, well, it's not obvious. There's no terminal Lagrangian that does it. But it gives you proton decay from one of these non-perturbative effects called an anomaly. But I'm not worried, because if you go and estimate the rate from that, it's way longer than the age of the universe. Not a single proton in my body has ever decayed. You know, just the probability of that's minuscule. And I got a lot of protons in me. A lot more since I've been eating the perimeter, too. So, you know, there's more to the standard model than what I've done. I picked out a section that doesn't... So these effects that we're describing, the non-perturbative ones, are some of the most subtle ones. They require a more in-depth explanation, and this is a very small class, the time window is small. You do what you can do.
Short.
Short. Thank you. English. Yeah. My first language.
I was comparing with long and short.
Yeah. Okay, have a core. Yeah. Okay, so pictures. Everybody likes pictures. You like pictures? Who likes pictures?
Yes.
Who said yes first? Pardon? Was it you?
Okay. No.
I'm gonna toss it between you. Somebody grab it. Okay, so let's write out this unitary relation. I'm going to draw a picture for you. I'm going to so we have this thing. We have Vji star Vjk equals delta ik. So I'm going to pick I equals b and k equals d. And I'm just going to write this out. So it's Vub star Vub plus VCB star VCD. Isn't this relaxing? I feel good about that equation. And now I'm going to divide by, which one do I'm going to divide by? I'm going to divide by this one. So I get an equation that looks like this, VUB star VUD over VCB star VCD plus VTB star VTD, the last one now. This is a complex number. This is a complex number. This is a complex number with zero imaginary part. where three, you could represent a complex number in the plane as a vector, the length of which is given by the magnitude of this, and the orientation of this vector, and the phase gives you the orientation of the vector. So let's represent each of these three things as a complex vector. And we know the vectors add up to zero, so they form the sides of a triangle. Everybody with me so far? So here we are in the complex plane. And, well, one of them's one, so it's along the real axis. So that's one side. And then there's so certain conventions here. I guess the convention is that this side is minus as a vector VUD, VUB star over VCD. So that's this vector. And then we take the other one from the origin and we move it along without changing its orientation. And it goes here. And then this one goes here, so they add up. So you get a triangle. This triangle, you okay?
I was wondering, how did you get the last line from the second line in the letters?
Zero. Pardon? Oh, this is zero.
Yeah.
Sorry. Thanks. Here, have a quarter. It's my last quarter. I can't give it to you. You have to save it. Yeah, thanks. Sorry. Yeah, this is an off-diagonal element. I equals B, K equals D. So the unitary thing gives you zero. So this triangle, this is a good-looking triangle, don't you think? You might say, why did I pick these two elements, not another one, not like BS? If you pick other ones, the triangle sucks. It's like squashed. You know, it looks awful. This looks like a robot's triangle. So that's why this was picked. So this is called the unitarity triangle. And these are things you want to measure. And this point here is usually given coordinates, rho plus I eta. And this characterizes CP violation. So sometimes people talk about rho and eta, and sometimes people give the angles names, like this one's beta, this one's gamma. Physicists love to name stuff. This one's alpha. And if you look at that asymmetry, oh, it's all coming together now, folks. If you worked it all out, this ends up being equal to sine 2 beta. I haven't shown you that, but if you worked out that asymmetry in terms of the angles, it's not so hard to do, you would get that. So sometimes you'll hear about rho and eta or the angles, and that's because different measurables might have a simpler expression when expressed in terms of the angles or the rho and eta than the elements of the CKM matrix. It's called the unitarity triangle. When I first learned about it, I thought, who the hell cares? You got the formula, right? We got V there with all those elements. That's everything you need to know. But you know, in physics, sometimes thinking about things geometrically could help you. And so this is a very common way to phrase things. Okay. Well, we got 2 minutes left. I'll tell you a little. Yes?
So
rho plus I eta is this element, basically.
I was just going to say that, you know, the homework has been posted on the wiki. If they have questions.
Right. Oh, yeah. I meant to mention that. Yeah. So the homework's posted. I'm around today. So try to read it over today. And you don't have to do it. But if you don't understand something and you want to talk to me about it, this is your last chance. Yes?
So you mentioned yesterday that something is called spray on and off.
So when you do group theory,
yeah.
So sometimes you have a fixed matrix. Like let's say we had an operator, Q bar, where Q is. So I guess given that I'm answering this question now, this is as far as we're going on CP violation and the CKM matrix. You can look in the particle data book. They have a beautiful section on this, and they'll tell you the sizes and the major ways that each of the elements are determined, what experiments do it. And it's also much more briefly described in my notes. Okay, so now I'll go to the question. So let's say I have an operator. Here's an operator. Let's say it's right-handed fields. And remember, Q here is, maybe I shouldn't write it in the middle of everything. What do you think? Doesn't bother you? Trying to be pedagogical. I'll erase something. So I want to say, if you come by to see me, it's possible I'll be out for a few minutes because I got to talk to some people. It's my last day, but you know, especially towards the end, before dinner, I'll probably be there for sure. But just return. Anyways, let's say we had an operator like this: Q bar right, T Q right, where Q is UDS. Let's even make it more complicated. Okay, let's say it's times. Q bar right, maybe there's a gamma mu here, and some times Q bar right, gamma mu. We're going to make it really complicated. Okay, this is a four-quark operator. T is a particular matrix. It's a particular matrix that's traceless. You with me so far? This is an operator O. Happy? Okay. Look happy. This is an operator O. It's not invariant under SU3 left cross SU3 right, right? If I transform the fields, this part's invariant because it's summed over all the quarks. You'll get V left dagger V left. But here you won't. You'll get V right dagger T V right. T is just a fixed matrix. So it's not an invariant under that transformation. So when you have something that's not an invariant, it transforms in some way, it's in some representation, and you can decompose that in group theory into what are called irreducible representations. It might contain many of them. And then, so you could figure out what representation of the group SU3 right this is in. It's a singlet under SU3 left. It ends up it's octet right. So this operator, you say, is octet right, singlet left under SU3 right cos SU3 left. Usually you do the left first, but it doesn't matter. You with me so far? You don't have to know it's an octet. Just trust me there. That's what you get. I mean, if you know enough group theory, it'll be clear. But if not, it won't. So in chiral perturbation theory, this operator might cause a k to the k to 2 pi's and to 3 pi's. And at low momentum, since they have low mass, we want to represent that by an operator involving sigma in the chiral Lagrangian. So all you do is say, this transforms in this way. Write down the thing involving sigma with the least number of derivatives that transforms in the same way. Okay. And well, that might be hard to do, because you don't know how to do group theory, like me. So what you do is you do the Spurian method of doing the group theory. You say, this operator would be invariant if T actually transformed, like R, T, R dagger. So you pretend T transforms in this way, and then you take your chiral Lagrangian, put T in, transforming this way once, because it's only once in this operator, and write invariants. And that's a lot easier than doing the group theory and figuring out what transforms in this way. And that's called the Spurian method of doing group theory. We are really just doing group theory by this. And that's what I would recommend for the homework as well. Okay? Well, class, the party's over. And it was fun for me. I hope it was fun for you. And I hope you learned something. Have a great rest of your